You may remember this Rilke poem from a couple of weeks ago. You may have heard it here. You may have heard it at the retreat. And you may not have been here a couple of weeks ago, and so this might be the first time you're hearing the poem, "Go to the Limits of Your Longing." God speaks to each of us as God makes us, then walks us silently out of the night. These are the words we dimly hear. You, sent out beyond your recall, go to the limits of your longing. Embody me. Flare up like a flame and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me. Nearby is the country they call life. You will know it by its seriousness. Give me your hand. Rosh Hashanah begins at sundown on Wednesday and lasts until sundown on Friday. This is the new year in the Jewish tradition. And it makes some sense to me to have the new year at this time when the harvest is coming in and the season is turning. In fact, we start our church year now. We start school now. This is the time of year when we are recommitting to all kinds of things. In the Jewish tradition, people eat apples dipped in honey at this time of year and wish each other a sweet new year. And that makes sort of visceral sense to us. We are surrounded by apples this time of year. And this is the beginning of 10 days of repentance. For it's said that God writes everyone's fate into the book of life on Rosh Hashanah. But then there's this little window between now and Yom Kippur in which you can do your work, your repentance, your confessing of your shortcomings and your failures, the ways that you have hurt or aggrieved others, and ask forgiveness, make compensation for what you have done wrong in the world. And it's said that if you turn your life and your heart back toward your better nature, if you make amends for what you've done wrong, God may be willing to reconsider what has been written in the book. But the thing that's interesting to me about the High Holy Days is that you don't really start your work by asking God for forgiveness. You start your work with your fellow humans, your fellow living creatures. And it is on these earthly relationships that God assesses how you are doing in your life. I think that is an interesting religious practice, to say it starts here among us. So it seems to me that Rosh Hashanah is about turning back to each other, turning away from our distractions, our addictions, and we all have some versions of addictions, our old inherited patterns that we keep meaning to break. This kind of repentance is less about being right and bowing to authority and more about reestablishing relationship, returning to right action, living in covenant again. Part of the Hebrew word for repentance is shub, or to turn. So repentance in the Jewish tradition is about turning ourselves around. It's a word that is shared between Christianity and Judaism, but the words mean something a little bit different in the two traditions, and I think the distinction is important. In Judaism, the work is the ethical work between people, and there isn't an intermediary for that work. And I think that's a useful thing for us to think about in this world. And I, who am always noticing the connections among things in the world, noticed that just before we get to this new year, this time of repentance and reflection, the climate change march was happening in New York City. And I put those two things together in my mind. 15 or 20 of our members are there. You probably have friends and family members who are also there. From our congregation, we have some folks who are retired who have gone, some people who will make it back just in time for work tomorrow. And we have a number of college students who are, well, some of them are already in New York, so they can show up with extra exuberance, but some of them have traveled a distance to be there. And this march feels to me like part of our collective repentance, like a turning. It's called the People's Climate March. And they're talking about having all people turn their minds and hearts and attention to the climate. It's scheduled to start at 11:30, so you can have some coffee and then go home and live stream it if you want to. It is, of course, being live streamed. And there's that march, but there's also, I think New York City has been taken over for at least the weekend by meditation groups and education groups, theological groups and scientific groups, and it also just so happens that world leaders are gathered at the UN for an important meeting about the climate. So there is an important gathering and a turning. It feels like a moment when humans are gathering themselves more completely to make different choices, individually and collectively, to acknowledge our shortcomings and our failures, the ways we have hurt or grieved the world around us, to ask forgiveness, and then begin to make compensation. One of the people who I always turn to when it comes to this work of engaging our relationship with the environment is Joanna Macy. She is a Buddhist teacher, and she calls herself an eco-philosopher. And she talks about the Great Turning. She is not the only leader in environmentalism who talks about the Great Turning. But they talk about it as a shift in consciousness that is slowly coming as we slowly turn ourselves. She says it is a turning from the industrial expansion society to a sustainable society. And she has been working on behalf of the Earth since she was part of protests against Seabrook Reactor in 1977. Were any of you involved in those protests? You might have been there with her. Did you see her? You don't know. She wasn't world known at the time. She was also just showing up because she didn't like what was happening there. Over time, she has developed a number of programs that she says are about the work that reconnects. And she has developed rituals and programs of all kinds. She has a ritual that she calls the Council of All Beings, in which she invites humans to notice their sense of being separated from the natural world and the ways that they are longing to reconnect. She thinks that the world is really part of our extended body. I don't think she actually thinks of it that way anymore. I think she experiences it that way now. And she's inviting all kinds of people to also experience their connection with the world in that profound and visceral way. She hopes to have people meet their sense of loss and despair and truly feel it. Not just that fleeting sense of emptiness mid-afternoon in a cubicle, but the deeper sense of loss that is more profound and always there. And for her, very motivating. She says, as most Buddhist teachers do, that we must learn to sit with our grief and our fear. She says, if you sit with your grief, it turns into something else. Into your love of the world, of life, of each other. So as we think about the climate march or more local work, we always have to learn to tolerate the sorrow so that we can meet that larger love. The story I have about this also comes from the west coast of our country. It is a story of two people who founded an organization called the Great Whale Conservancy. And part of what they have done is spend part of each year in the Sea of Cortez, which is that little bit of ocean between Baja California and Sonora, Mexico. It's a piece of ocean that we're not particularly familiar with if you also haven't been west of the Mississippi yet. But it's an important place if you are a whale or a follower of whales. And these people contributed to the conservation of whales by photographing, particularly humpbacks, in that narrow strip of ocean. So they were out, five of them, including one child, were out in a fairly small boat on Valentine's Day in 2011. And they had an encounter they weren't prepared for. They came across a whale that was just floating in the water. And they stopped their boat and floated next to the whale for a while. And when whales are just floating like that, it usually means they've died. And you can hear them in their video talking about why has the whale died and should they do anything about it. And they're sort of stunned to be looking at this beautiful creature who is gone. But then the whale exhales forcefully, as they do. So one of the photographers got into the water with his snorkel gear, and looking under the surface of the water could see that the whale was entirely tangled in fishing net. All of its fins and its tail were pinned, so it couldn't move. The weights from the fishing net were weighing down the tail of the whale, so it was almost being sunk, which is hard to do with those buoyant creatures. And it was clear that the whale was near death. And here was this man in the water, eye to eye with this whale who was sinking. Well, he went back to the boat and reported, and they looked around and they found a small knife on board. And they started cutting at this netting. It's thin nylon netting, which means it's easier to tangle yourself up in, but also possible to cut away. And they cut at the netting, and they cut at the netting. And after a while, they got one flipper free, which of course meant that the whale began to move because it could sense freedom. And if you're a little person next to a huge whale, that's a slightly frightening experience. So the snorkeler retreated to the boat, where they continued for another hour to pull at the netting and cut it and pull and cut and pull and cut until the boat was full of nylon netting and weights for this fishing net. But they got one flipper free and then another, and finally they freed the tail. And the whale swam away, about 500 feet away. And then it breached. Have you gotten to see a whale breach? They're just huge and they throw themselves up out of the water into the air, which doesn't really seem possible, and yet they do it. And this one breached, and the people on the boat were thrilled, and then the whale breached again, and again, and again, for an hour. And on the video, you can hear this little child saying, "I know what she's doing. She's showing us how happy she is." And the photographer and the scientists agreed. These people did not have any particular skill or training for freeing whales from fishing line. Really, all they had was their great love of whales, the capacity to show up, and a small blade. If freeing a humpback from human-made fishing line isn't repentance and atonement at its finest, I don't know how to refine those words. Joanna Macy says, "You are always asked to stretch a little bit more. And actually, we're made for that. Go to the limits of your longing. Embody me. Flare up like a flame and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me." We are at a turning time of year, a turning time of life, a turning time for our planet, I do think. I ask you to find that love, that deepest, strongest love, which is always there, and embody it.